The World Series starts tonight, as does the NBA season. Have we ever seen anything like this Patriots defense? Sam Darnold seeing ghosts. It is Tuesday here on Home and Home, radio.com sports original, brought to you by ZipRecruiter. The smartest way to hire, try ZipRecruiter for free. Right now, it's ZipRecruiter.com/enter. Big show for you today. Kevin Millar from MLB Network joins us in the 8 o'clock hour to preview the World Series. Is this the best pitching matchup we've ever seen? Mike Jones, USA Today, in the 9 o'clock hour. He talked to Lamar Jackson and witnessed him firsthand. What surprised him? Matt McGloin, XFL quarterback, former Penn State guy you all know. And Kendrick Perkins closes us out in the 10 o'clock hour, former Celtic star. Says, what's going on with Zion Williamson? Should we all panic? 6 to 8 weeks, the big fella is out. What does it mean for the NBA? I'm Dave Briggs, home in Connecticut. Ross Tucker, home in Pennsylvania, breaking down another historic and dominant effort by this Patriots defense. It was ugly early, 33-0. The Patriots are plus 175 in this 7-0 start. Ross, good morning to you. We start with Sam Darnold, who was mic'd up for this game. And don't you ever get mic'd up playing the Patriots. Don't do it. He will never shed this label. I promise you, never. T-shirts will be made. Ghost will be in the stands the next time he plays in Gillette Stadium. Explain to the audience what Sam Darnold was or was not seeing.
Right. Well, it's funny, Dave, because, you know, we like when we have access, right? We like when we get a chance to hear what these guys have to say. I even thought it was interesting earlier in the game on his first interception. He said to the guys, hey, that's on me. I need to be louder to tell them that 58 was the Mike linebacker that he wanted them to pick up. And by the way, he was plenty loud. It was a mental error by the right guard, Brian Winters. And I give Darnold a lot of credit for taking responsibility when it wasn't on him. It was on his offensive line, but he wanted to, you know, I think he just wanted to keep things positive and say, I got to be louder, even though I screamed for you to block that guy and you literally didn't block the guy I screamed for you to block. I need to be louder. That's on me, guys. And seeing ghosts is an expression that quarterbacks use in particular, but I've heard other players say it before, coaches, when you're just not seeing things clearly. You're just not seeing the field very well. You're not seeing things right. You're seeing ghosts. He obviously wasn't really seeing ghosts. He just wasn't seeing the field all that well. But if you look at it, Dave, I mean, they had guys coming free a lot, and Darnold, rather than, you know, throwing the ball away or taking sacks, was trying to make plays, throwing the ball off his back foot. It wasn't very smart. It didn't seem to me like they had very much of an answer for all of these blitzes. And by the way, it wasn't complicated, Dave. What they did is they came with what you call cover zero, which is man-to-man across the board. And then you bring one more defender than the offense can block. You get a guy to come scot-free, and you got to make him pay if you're on offense. You have to have an answer. The Jets didn't. They couldn't. So the Patriots just kept bringing it.
And in the end, Sam Darnold, 11 of 32, 86 yards, 4 interceptions, another fumble for 5 turnovers, and a stunning 3.6 quarterback rating. I didn't see the ghost. It seemed a bit simpler. And Adam Gase seemed to reiterate the same thing. All right, we'll stand by for that. We do have Adam Gase, the head coach of the Jets, essentially saying, I don't think they were disguising that much. Look, I was home on my couch, so I don't know what it's like facing arguably the best defense of all time. They were bringing the house each and every time. Yes, from a coverage standpoint, I'm sure it varied. But look, most of this night was on Sam Darnold. He was not picking up the blitzes. He did not know what to do with it. He was throwing every ball, I thought, off of his back foot, not stepping into anything, throwing balls up. I mean, it's amazing. This is the same kid that beat the Dallas Cowboys a week ago. again, greatest defense we've seen in modern history, arguably, but isn't an awful lot of this on Darnold himself, Ross?
Well, the throws, the interceptions, and the fumble, that's all on him. That's all on him. He is ultimately responsible and the guy with the football. Now, I will say this. I disagree with Adam Gase. Like, even the fumble by Darnold, which really just helped to snowball things, they brought two linebackers from the left side. Those guys really bluffed. They really just came to engage the left tackle and left guard so that the Jets slid the line that way. You have to account for those guys. I mean, if they're up there, you have to account for them. So they slid, and every Jets blocker had their Patriot, and then a guy came free off the edge. That, to me, is disguising. I mean, they're doing a good job of bluffing on the left side and then bringing the extra guy from the right. So they drop those guys out, but by then it's too late. So I thought they did actually do some disguising. But then after that, to your point, Dave, it was a lot of cover zero. We're just going to bring one more guy. I don't put it all on Darnold, though. The throws, the interceptions are on Darnold. But how do you not have more hot routes or sight adjustments or more answers from a coaching perspective? He can't throw those balls. He can't throw it off his back foot like that. He's got to throw it away or take a sack or whatever. But I didn't think it looked to me like Adam Gase provided him with very many answers, because when they did bring the extra guy, Dave, it didn't look like there was anywhere to throw the ball.
Yeah, you're right about that. Several of these throws, it looked like a quarterback having given in to what he was facing, throwing the ball up. In particular, the interception he threw in the end zone, I think it was in the second quarter. There wasn't the Jets receiver within 5 yards of that football. Now we do have Adam Gase explaining what he saw from a blitz perspective.
It didn't look like there were a handful of times where it didn't look like the Patriots were disguised. I mean, they were just...
No, it's, there is no disguise. It's, I mean, they're telling you what they're doing.
So what? I mean, jeez, how discouraging, how can you fix it when they're just saying, hey, this guy's blitzing?
And it gets tough when they go all their little guys and trying to figure out who's doing what, who's covering who has the tight end, who has the back. It just, it can get tough sometimes.
And why do you guys have so much trouble with their blitzes?
Well, I mean, we'd be one of seven teams that's had trouble, or I guess six since we've played them twice. You know, we didn't pick anything up right. We screwed up on some of the mic points. We didn't honor some of the mic points. They got there a little quicker than we got rid of the ball. I mean, we didn't do anything right.
At least he had answers for questions, because Adam Gase had no answer for anything Bill Belichick threw at him. Let's let Sam Darnold explain what he saw. In this case, he was seeing things that weren't there.
Well, ESPN caught that seeing ghost comments. How do you feel about that? What were you thinking then? What can you share about that?
Yeah, you know, I think for me, I just gotta, you know, just when I talk to the coaches, I just gotta be, you know, straight up. And you know, for me, I just got to see the field a lot better. That's kind of what that means. And, you know, just it was a rough day out there, rough night out there. And obviously I got to be better and learn from the mistakes. But we will get better.
Got to get a lot better. Cover of the New York Post this morning, a pretty easy one. Boo, as Sam Darnold is seeing ghosts. So let's turn to this Patriots defense. 18 interceptions, Ross. That is more than the Saints, Lions, Texans, Raiders, Bengals, Falcons, Cardinals, and Dolphins all combined. They've allowed 30 points. This defense has allowed 30 points last 8 games, and that includes a Super Bowl against the Rams. Have you ever seen anything like this in modern times? I'm a little older than you, so I certainly remember watching a lot of 85 Bears and, of course, 2000 Ravens. Have you ever seen anything like we're seeing right now?
You know, it's interesting, Dave, because it feels like they're most dominant in the secondary, like on the back end. You know, when I remember the Ravens and the Bears, it just feel like they just destroyed quarterbacks every single play, just blew everything up, you know, with that defense, the 46 defense, everybody up on the line of scrimmage, and teams had no answer for it, which I guess is kind of like how the Jets, in my mind, I guess, Dave, the 85 Bears looked like the Patriots did last night every game. Just guys running in the backfield, blowing people up, etc. I don't feel like that is the hallmark of this Patriots team. I feel like the hallmark of the team is really the secondary. And I can't remember another defense where they were this dominant and the strength of the team was the secondary. Even for the Ravens, you know, you had Ray Lewis and Peter Boulware, Michael McCrary. You know, you had a lot of guys in the front seven that were probably the most dominant players. They did have Chris McAllister. That was, of course, before Ed Reed was a member of the Baltimore Ravens. But this is the first one I can remember where the defensive backfield is this dominant. Devin McCourty and Stephon Gilmore in particular are playing unbelievable football right now. And it's kind of fun. It's kind of fun to see a defensive back dominated defense that can be this good.
Yeah, I think Stephon Gilmore is the number one corner in football right now. And I looked at it historically thinking, I don't remember this kind of shutout type dominance. So I went back and looked at the 85 Bears and looked at the 2000 Ravens. And in fact, it is different in that the 85 Bears allowed more points in week one than the Patriots have allowed this season. The 2000 Ravens allowed more points in week two than this Patriots team have all season. So you could argue from a point standpoint, they are far more dominant than the 85 Bears or 2000 Ravens. And again, that's in terms of the points they are not allowing. They are absolutely wrecking opposing offenses. Let's hear from Tom Brady and Bill Belichick.
That was a good start. It was a good drive. And anytime you can go, I don't know, 7 or 8 minutes, whatever that was, put the ball in the end zone on the road, kind of gets you a good feel. So good to get a win. Three division road wins, that's pretty sweet. And try to have a quick turnaround, get ready for Cleveland.
Tom, does your defense continue to just amaze you each and every week when they go out and get shut out like this?
They're playing great. They're just playing great football. They're doing a great job. They cover, rush, stop the run, make critical plays. So they're just, it's awesome to watch.
You know, always good to win a division game on the road. Thought that, you know, our guys were we're ready to go today. Got off to a good start. That was a great opening drive. Seemed like took up most of the first quarter. You know, had some turnovers on defense. Good complimentary football all the way across the board. Offense, defense, special teams. A lot of guys contributed tonight, which is what you need for a good division win on the road. So, you know, got to give the players a lot of credit. They played hard. They played relentlessly, and you know, we're able to make some plays early in the game and, you know, play pretty solid for 60 minutes. So short week, quick turnaround here. I'll have to get going on Cleveland in a hurry, but always good to win a division game on the road.
So as revealing as it was to hear Sam Darnold say, I'm seeing ghosts, perhaps the most revealing moment was not saying a word, a shot of Bill Belichick on the sideline and that smirk about the closest thing you get to him breaking out an enormous smile. He was enjoying every second of devouring the New York Jets. And now, I mean, they get better. They even get better. And by the way, they were mentioning that opening drive, 16 plays, 8 minutes, 47 seconds. It was a Mike Tyson punch in the face. They get better this morning with some breaking news that they have traded for Mohamed Sanu, wide receiver from the Atlanta Falcons. They give up a second-round pick, which probably falls around in the 60 range, given how high they ought to finish. Is this a good deal, Ross? And how much better does it make the Patriots' offense? Does he fit in right behind Julian Edelman now as a number two option for this offense?
Well, he's a very good player, and he certainly fits the Patriots' mold. Because he's versatile, he can play inside in the slot, he can play outside. He's very physical, a very willing blocker. He's excellent run after the catch. He's from Rutgers. We know how much the Patriots love Rutgers players. By the way, can we talk about that for a second? Is it not weird to you that the best NFL team of the last 20 years loves getting players from the worst at Power 5 FBS program? Like, how is it possible that that is the case? I mean, I'm like blown away that they have that many. I think they have like six Rutgers guys on their team right now. Need a millennial to look that up for me. Millennials, get on. Millennials, unite. Get on that one.
Let's go, millennials.
And yes, let's go. Come on, crack the whip. Not living in your parents' basement anymore. You got to start paying some bills, millennials. Dude.
But this
sounds like
a Ross Tucker column. Yeah. And you tell me why, because it's gone throughout different coaches. I know you've looked at this. What can it be? Is it a physical characteristic? Is it the intelligence? That's the one of the things he always looks for in a ball player. How do you account for it?
Yeah, it's a great topic. So I think there's a couple answers, right? Number one, most of these guys were recruited and coached by Greg Schiano, who Belichick has a lot of respect for. So a lot of these guys, the McCourties, Sanu, you know, they played when Schiano was there and Rutgers was good, actually. So that credit to them. I don't think there have been as many Rutgers guys the last few years. A lot of these guys are guys that were there from Schiano. And also when Steve Belichick, Bill Belichick's son, was at Rutgers and was a manager helping out on the football team. Maybe he was a walk-on. I can't remember. But I think that they feel like because of Schiano and Steve Belichick, they know more about these guys. That's my guess. But it is kind of fascinating. Now, I'll tell you this, Dave. I'm a little surprised by a second-round pick for Mohamed Sanu. A second-round pick for Mohamed Sanu with 2 years left on his deal? That sounds pretty rich until you consider the Patriots stink at second-round picks. And they really stink at drafting wide receivers. It's unbelievable how many bad second-round picks they've had and how many bad wide receiver picks they've had. Sanu was under contract for the next 2 years, very affordable, $3.7 million for the rest of this year, $6.5 million next year. I think that was the key for the Patriots, is to have that flexibility of having Sanu for next year. Let me tell you one more thing, Dave. I want to get this on the record. 8:18 a.m. on Tuesday, Mohamed Sanu will throw a touchdown pass for the Patriots this year. I'm guaranteeing it. Oh, yeah. And by the way, between Edelman and Sanu now, the Patriots have the best throwing wide receivers in NFL history. The best pair of passing wide receivers in NFL history. It's crazy.
It is incredible. I thought I was surprised, too, to hear a second-round pick, in all honesty, from Mo Sanu. Guy that caught 66 balls, more than 800 yards, certainly makes this wide receiver core a lot better, because no one's sure what to expect right now from Josh Gordon in terms of the injury, and even if he's healthy, how much he adds. I guess I thought they would make a move for Emmanuel Sanders, who certainly isn't as big and physical as Mo Sanu, but I view him as a more talented player, a bigger playmaker that Tom Brady could take advantage of. But Adam Schefter went on the Greg Hill Show on WEEI this morning and said he would not be surprised if the Patriots made another move before the deadline. So where could they add? Obviously, the position of need for the Patriots is the offensive line. But given that you just gave up a second-round pick, I think the asking price for a top-level offensive lineman is more than Bill Belichick is willing to give up. So where might they acquire, and how bad is that for everybody else in the NFL right now?
Well, I think the position that certainly jumps out, like you said, is offensive line, and the guy is Trent Williams. I don't think that the Redskins are going to do it, but both the Browns and the Patriots, I think, desperately want Trent Williams. Yeah. So I'd be very curious to see what the Redskins can get. Here's the issue, though, Dave. The Redskins are one of those few organizations that it's important enough to them to not set a precedent and to make a point that they won't trade Trent Williams this year. They might not. Because here's the thing. From a Redskins perspective, Trent Williams is under contract next year as well. So they can make their point, Dave, of, hey, we're not gonna let you dictate getting out of here. You wanna sit out and try to go somewhere else? No, we're gonna hold fast because they already stink. They're already not going anywhere this year. There's really no value for the Redskins at this point of even winning football games for the rest of this season. So they can make their point, stand on their principle as it relates to Trent Williams, and then still trade him in the offseason, Dave, before next year's draft. So whether it's the Browns or the Patriots, they don't really have anything unique to offer the Redskins now other than ponying up more draft compensation now than they would perhaps in March or April. Because from a Redskins standpoint, what difference does it make to them if they trade him now or they trade him in March or April? They're getting those draft picks for next year anyway, and they can prove their point. So the Redskins actually are in the driver's seat for multiple reasons. Number one is they're not in a rush to trade Trent Williams. And number two, I think they have multiple suitors, such as the Patriots and the Browns. I think it's offensive line, maybe tight end, although I don't know what tight ends would be available right now. That's another position potentially for the Patriots, but that's about it.
Yeah, I would expect Trent Williams to get moved in the next 24 hours because you have to smell the desperation coming from Cleveland. They play the New England Patriots this week. Baker Mayfield has to be shaking in his cleats. He's already seeing ghosts. That guy's had happy feet and has been nervous in the pocket, and he hasn't faced anything like the New England Patriots. We'll talk about a couple of other guys that could get moved before the deadline. And I want to ask you, look, bottom line is the Patriots have beaten nobody. We'll talk about that in just a sec in terms of the upcoming schedule. Bound to get a lot tougher for New England.
But first, it's a ZipRecruiter Tuesday. Dylan Miskiewicz, my guy. He needed to hire a director of coffee for his organic coffee company, but he was having trouble finding qualified applicants. He switched to ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its technology identifies people with the right experience and invites them to apply to your job. So you get qualified candidates and you get them fast. Dylan posted his job on ZipRecruiter and said he was impressed by how quickly he had great candidates apply. He also used ZipRecruiter's candidate rating feature to filter his applicants so he could focus on the most relevant ones. That's how Dylan found his new director of coffee in just a few days. With results like that, it's no wonder 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. See why ZipRecruiter is effective for businesses of all sizes. Try ZipRecruiter for free at our web address, ZipRecruiter.com/enter. That's ZipRecruiter.com/ENTER. ZipRecruiter.com/enter. ZipRecruiter. The smartest way to hire.
So the Patriots defense has scored 104 fantasy points. That is unbelievable. How good is that? That is QB6 for all you fantasy football fans. A dominant effort, but they really have played nobody, and it gets a lot harder ahead. Cleveland, not entirely sure what that means. But after that, it's at Baltimore, bye, at Philly, home for Dallas, at Houston. And then they take on Kansas City, the game we all have circled. Expect Patrick Mahomes to be back for that one. Do we truly know how good this Patriots team is? And once that offense begins to face some better defenses, will we get a much better idea of just how dominant a complete team they are?
Right. I don't think they're going to go 16-0, Dave. I mean, they've got some tougher teams coming up here. I think they'll lose a game or two, but it almost reminds me of, you know, like a high school schedule or certain college schedules where they really only have to gear up and play their best for a couple of games. Because these other games, when they play the Dolphins again, they obviously have already played the Jets twice. They'll have to play for the Bills. They'll have to show up for the Eagles and some other teams. But they get a lot of almost weeks off, if you will, with this schedule. So they really only have a few games that they really have to play at a high level. My guess is they'll lose one of them. I don't think they're dominant enough offensively to go 16-0. But if they beat, if they win some of these games, they might go 16-0. I mean, it's crazy because you look at them offensively, and they're really not very impressive. No. I mean, it's the worst offensive line they've had in a while, Dave. Their skill guys are not great. Yet, like you said, you know, you called it a Mike Tyson knockout. I actually felt like that opening drive was like almost more like Floyd Mayweather. You know,
it was
like
the little
every
play
was 5 yards. Yeah, it was like 5 yards, 5 yards, 5 yards, 5 yards, 5 yards. Like death by a million paper cuts, as opposed to a big knockout, you know, 75-yard touchdown. It's really hard to do because you have one negative play, one penalty, and you're off schedule. But they don't do those things. It's quite impressive how consistently efficient they are on the offensive side of the ball.
All right, and finally, a question for you. As we approach the October 29 deadline, we heard Mo Sanu moved. I mentioned Emmanuel Sanders. I think he's out of Denver. Chris Harris could be on the market. Vic Beasley apparently on the market. Atlanta, $12.8 million number. Didn't even start last week for the Falcons. And how about Cam Newton? Some feel quietly he could be moved. What's the big blockbuster trade you think happens in the next week?
I don't see that happening with Cam. That would be unbelievable, though. That would be one of the biggest in-season trades in a long time. Let me throw one out to you, Dave. What about Nick Foles? What about Nick Foles if you are like the Chicago Bears? What about Nick Foles? I mean, you know, he's been in the Andy Reid, Doug Peterson system, which is what Matt Nagy is running in Chicago. He would clearly be an upgrade over Mitch Trubisky. He's under contract for several more years. And I got to tell you, I think the Jags would be open to it because I think that they're kind of into Minshew now. I think they're kind of like, you know what? Why do we want to pay Foles $20 million a year when Minshew's maybe just as good? We're winning with Minshew. We're playing pretty good. Like, I think Foles could be the big blockbuster. But it makes it really tricky with Foles and Cam Newton that we don't really know their health status. That makes it really tough.
Nick Foles to Chicago would be interesting, would certainly make them better, but they've got to figure out the running game. And that was one of the more baffling things, and we don't have a whole lot of time to delve into it, but they were up 10-9 in that football game Sunday and then answered with 9 straight passes. Matt Nagy can say he wants to establish the run, but he's not trying. I can't help but think, if all the storm clouds have gone away with Kareem Hunt, could they make a move for him? We know he is still an elite running back, and if the PR hit is not too bad, I don't understand why Cleveland needs him and Nick Chubb. Nick Chubb, top 5 or 6 back in this league. It's going to be a fascinating next week before the NFL trade deadline. Tonight, Major League Baseball starts the Fall Classic. Is it the best ever World Series pitching matchup all the way down? It is incredible, the amount of talent on these two staffs, but it may come down to this question. Rest versus rust. What is more important? We'll ask Kevin Millar, the host of Intentional Talk from MLB Network, right after a quick break.
Swung on and hit in the end of deep left. It is high. It is far. It is gone to win the series. Jose Altuve hit a 2-run home run. The Astros win 6-4, and they capture this series 4-2. And the place is going absolutely bananas.
And with that, the Astros in the World Series and the Yankees, first time they haven't reached a World Series in a decade in 100 years. How about Jose Altuve? Let's talk about the little man with Kevin Millar, the host of Intentional Talk on MLB Network. Catch them 5 o'clock Eastern time. Kev about to head out to Houston for the World Series. Good to see you, man. Dave Briggs, Ross Tucker. Jose Altuve, 5'6". Have you ever seen any player in Major League history make more out of less?
No. You know what he does? He gives every kid hope in the world. This guy, and I don't care, it's sad because no matter what, when you mention Jose Altuve, the first thing you say is, oh, man, it's a little guy. And you know what? That's okay. He embraces that. But at 5'6", it's what makes our game of baseball awesome. With Aaron Judge at 6'7" and Jose Altuve at 5'6", and Randy Johnson was at 6'10". You know, anybody could play a sport, but at such a high level, what he does. And I love every single comment or finishing statement about Jose Altuve. Beyond his 3 batting titles and his MVP of the American League and his World Series rings and his 5 silver sluggers and his couple gold gloves and all of these accolades, they always end the statement as, he's a better person than he is player. And that goes a long way because of his calmness. And you can lead quietly. He's a quiet leader. He's not a vocal leader. He's a quiet leader. But what a guy, man.
So here's my question, Kev. By the way, I appreciate you giving us a different angle today of the Taj Mahal. I love that. I wanted to see. I had a buddy come over. I had a buddy come over the other night for the Eagles game. And he said, hey, I saw your tweet about Millar's pillars. That was awesome. That video was awesome. Who has that? And this guy's got some dough. He's like, who has that many pillars in their house? I'm like, I don't know. Evidently, Kevin Millar does. Unbelievable. So I love that you're giving us a different angle. Next time we do this, you're going to be on those stairs in the back left so we can get that angle too.
Time out.
Unbelievable.
Let me give you guys Lake Austin. Okay, that'll be the next angle. There's Austin, Texas with 0 mph wind, blue skies. So the weather in Houston is going to be gorgeous, guys. We're only 2 hours and 22 minutes away by car. So I just wanted to get – so weather is not a factor even though we're inside today.
So, Kev, I could look this up, but I mean, it's public records. How much money did you make playing Major League Baseball?
$20 million is what they make a year now. So that was 12 years. I spent $22 million. I made $20 million, so I've got minus $1,700 left in the checking account.
Hey, but my question is about Altuve is very simple. Tell me how height helps and hurts you as a baseball player, both in the field and at bat. Because I would think, like, in my mind, shorter guy can be easier to be a little rocked up. You have a smaller strike zone, probably easier when you're in the field to be quicker with your hands and feet to be able to turn to. Like, I don't see the negative of being short in baseball. Maybe I'm missing something.
Yeah, no, it's similarities to like Darren Sproles or somebody small on the NFL, you know, on the NFL field, right? You got a guy that's 5'6", but he's shifty and moves, run, and you're powerful. So size really doesn't matter in all sports. I mean, you could dominate at any level, even in the NBA at some point, to some extent, because of if you're quicker and faster and a nice disher. Baseball similar. You know, to hit in baseball, which is cool, we always talk about, it's like kind of like when Dave goes and pays a bill. You know, you got gator arms, you know, sometimes you can't reach in the pocket. Hitting's very similar, okay? Hitting's very similar to where everything is tight and inside, and then you extend. So really, when you got shorter arms, your good hitters are nice. You know, Barry Bonds, he was kind of all in here, right? You got tap, tap, and then boom. I think Jose Altuve, you got a strike zone that is tougher to, you know, tougher throw to, even though he hasn't seen a pitch he doesn't like. But with short arms, and he's fast, he's strong, he's powerful, his legs, and as you know, his butt. You look at all the power hitters. They got that high butt, big, strong legs. Altuve is short, but he's strong, you know, and a lot of these guys, Alex Bregman, Josh Donaldson, they're no bigger than 5'10", Mookie Betts. We're in this era of, like, small is good in baseball. And we're, you know, I mean, Dustin Pedroia's an MVP, he's 5'7". They all stopped growing at some point in ninth grade, but they've dominated at this level. And it's kind of fun to watch. Trevor Story over there in Colorado, I mean, these guys are hitting 35 to 45 home runs a year. And they're not very big, but they're strong and powerful. So Jose Altuve and being little, I think it's not that there's an advantage or disadvantage, but you do, you know, you got those short arms inside that strike zone when you got 98 trying to keep that bat inside to get the barrel to the ball. I think that's an advantage.
Talking to Kevin Millar, the host of Intentional Talk, 5 o'clock Eastern Time on MLB Network. You clearly talk to my friends. You know how I am about paying a bill at a dinner. Cheap son of a bitch. Yep, yep. Always looking to save a buck. I'm busted. All right, so if being tall is not an advantage, how about being hot in a postseason series? It's that rest versus rust argument, because Washington has not played a game now in a week, and that does not bode well. Only one of the last eight teams to sweep the LCS since 85 have gone on to win the World Series. It's a bad omen. How will it play into the series?
I think time will tell, Dave. And to be honest with you, it's the biggest thing we talk about, because you haven't faced live pitching. You could practice, you could work out, you can do all this stuff. But you know what? You haven't seen 98 miles an hour in probably, what, 4 or 5 days from this first pitch. So it happens a lot. We've seen it. I mean, back in the Tigers, I remember Detroit was a powerhouse. You had Miguel Cabrera and these big boys just got them sweeping somebody. I don't know if it was in the 2011, 12, and they went in there and got boat raced by the Rangers, I believe. And it happened because they sat there and swept and had to wait, you know, 4 or 5 extra days waiting for the next series to end. But I think in this situation, the Nationals are a hot team. The wild card teams are always a hotter team because they're playing must-win games. They're a very dangerous club. They're a plus 190 in Vegas for the odds, one of the highest odds of the World Series. But you only, you know, I got a buddy that asked me, like, why? I said, we're looking at three of the best matchups that we've seen probably in World Series. The first 2 days, we have the four best starters probably in baseball, right? Strasburg, Max Scherzer, you're looking at Gerrit Cole and Verlander. You can't make this up. So it's nice to see that. Then you go to Patrick Corbin and Zach Greinke. What a great three-hole matchup. But I know the Nationals haven't announced that they're game three starter because they might, you know, throw Corbin out of the bullpen a little bit first couple games and then do an Anibal Sanchez for a game three starter. We'll see how that plays out. But you know one thing, that you're going to get great starting pitching, and will the Nationals' bats be able to hit and battle and scrape and grind a couple runs off Gerrit Cole and Verlander to get a lead? Maybe. The problem is why they're underdogs is because their bullpen was 28th in the big leagues or 29th in the big leagues behind your Baltimore Orioles, who were worst. So they had like a 5.8 ERA, I believe. They got better, and they got hot towards the end of the season, and they definitely went through this postseason with no issues. But that'll be a factor getting those last six outs.
They were outstanding against the Cardinals. I think you mentioned 2012, I think, was the year, and it was a couple of pitchers that are in this series. Scherzer, Verlander, and Sanchez all pitched for Detroit.
Yes.
They swept. They went on to hit 159 in the World Series, and they were knocked out quickly. This is historic, though, to your point, for the top 10 pitchers by ERA, and this is the first time ever that five of the top 10 pitchers by strikeout are in the same series. Who has the better starting staff?
Man, I'll tell you, it's hard. I mean, Gerrit Cole's the best pitcher in the world right now. So you can go, if you're going right now, Gerrit Cole's number one, Strasburg's number two. I'd put Verlander in the three hole and Scherzer in the four hole from the last 2 weeks, right? So you're looking at unhittable Gerrit Cole, who hasn't lost, what, since August? So 25, 26, 27 starts, he hasn't lost a game. So he's the best. Strasburg in the postseason is probably one of the greatest statistical scenes that we've seen if you're doing stat-wise. And we've seen what he's done. He gave up three in L.A., finds a way to get through six, and they end up winning the game. I mean, he's just been dominating. And that was the question. Do you start him or Max Scherzer? I really don't care. You could have gone Strasburg against Gerrit Cole. They want Max Scherzer against Gerrit Cole. So what? Max Scherzer's a bulldog and a stud. He's going to give you everything he has. So I would put it Cole, Strasburg, I'd put Verlander and Scherzer, and I think we're in for a great pitcher's duel when we were talking about the juice balls all year long. Now we haven't seen that in the postseason, which tells you what? Good pitching stops good hitting. So all the pitchers that are giving up all these home runs and crying about how the ball is traveling out, go ahead and be better. Hit your spots, because you can see right here in the postseason we haven't had an issue.
Kev, do you think it's fair to say that if the Astros had to go, if Altuve doesn't have that home run, and the Astros had to go game seven and Cole pitches, let's just assume they would have won that. You think it's fair to say that that could be the difference in the series? Meaning if Cole, now that the Astros have Cole for three games if they need him, versus if he had to pitch game seven against the Yankees, that could have been the tilt for the World Series winner one way or the other?
Yeah, it's fun to talk about it because we talked about in game four when Verlander went into Tampa, you thought that was a must win. And he didn't get that W, so they had to put Garrett Cole in game five. And we were saying the same thing going in to face the Yankee series. So Yankees are better than the Nationals, and it worked out fine for the Yankees and the Astros situation. I just think this team's good, man. I mean, let's be honest. I mean, we can sit here and nitpick and figure out all these different scenarios and talk about bullpen. But when you're looking at this lineup of the Astros, who, by the way, grind you to death, they don't strike out much in an era where everybody doesn't care if they strike out. I mean, Aaron Judge, is on pace for 162 game season to strike out 220 times a year. That's just the norm. I mean, I remember when I played, Rossi, if I struck out 100 plus times, I was pissed off. When an outs and out, a pop up to the second base or a strikeout is the same. It ain't. I always took it like he got me. You know what I'm saying? I'll take a ground ball to the pitcher before he strikes me out, because that's, but this day and age, they don't care. But the Astros lineup, they battle you. They remind me of back in the day, and they remember, like, Posada, Bernie Williams. You just get up there, Jambi. It was grinding at bats when you faced the Yankees. So everybody talked about how long the games were, Red Sox, Yankees. Oh, my God, 4 hours. Yeah, because it seemed like every at bat went 8 to 10 pitches. So you look at a guy like Michael Brantley, he gets 0-2. You've already looked up, blink your eye, hits 3-2 with two foul balls, so he's on pitch number 9. That's what they do, and that's what makes them great.
All right, Kev, I don't really care about the Nationals or the Astros. I don't have a rooting interest. Which team should I and people like me root for, and why?
Well, it depends on if you want the legacy of the Astros trying to develop this scene like the Giants did in 2010, 2012, 2014. They were World Series champions. So you look up like, that's a dynasty. I don't care who you are. You can win 3 World Series rings in 5 years. That's what the Astros are trying to do. They're built to win for a long time. I think they've done a great, great job with this organization, building this farm system up, been adding who they need, and they're not afraid. So Lou Now and all these boys, they deserve a lot of credit. Jim Crane deserves a lot of credit as the owner. I think the Astros would be a fun team to root for because you don't see this often. To get to the World Series is tough. To win the World Series is tougher. Dodgers have been there the last few years and haven't sniffed the World Series as far as a W. Astros are back here again, and they're strong, and they're tough, and, they're a team to root for. But if you're rooting for first time in history, and here come the Washington Nationals, the Montreal and the Washington Nationals, same organization, kind of like the Colts and the Baltimore Colts, it kind of gets weird. If that makes sense. So it's going to be a great series. Flip a coin right there, Rossi, and I'd root for the Astros.
Get off the damn fence. We know you got to go. What's your prediction?
Predictions, I think Astros going to do it in 6. I think you'll see the Nationals grind and battle. Their starting pitch is too good, but I think it goes back to Houston, and Houston wins it here, game 6.
Kevin Millar on record. Houston wins it in 6. I want to see something bring the divided city of Washington, D.C. together. Go Nats! Plus, they got the baby shark thing with Para, makes me happy. I love that shit, man. That is the best new tradition in sports. Kevin Millar, enjoy the World Series. We'll talk to you later in the week. Catch him 5 o'clock Eastern time on MLB Network Intentional Talk. Thanks, Kev.
Thanks, boys.
All right, so he talked about there Jose Altuve. He said no one's ever done it for a short guy quite like the 5'6 Altuve, on the heels of Dustin Pedroia somewhat, who Kevin Millar played with there in Boston, little guy that could flat out mash it. On the heels of that, it made me think, who is the greatest, who is the all-Altuve team all time? The shortest, the best of the slightest, if you will. Jose Altuve, obviously, on my starting 5. Who else is on my starting 5? It's a pretty great list. Spud Webb, 5'7", of course, Atlanta Hawks, great, won a slam dunk contest at 5'7". Sorry, Muggsy Bogues, you don't make the cut at 5'3", but certainly honorable mention. Lionel Messi, 5'7", and arguably the greatest soccer player of all time. He has won 6 different Player of the Year awards. Some feel he is the GOAT. Barry Sanders, to me, the GOAT. Running back, the best of all time to me, 15,000 yards rushing, league MVP, 5'8". But the all-time greatest short athlete you're probably going to hate, Ross, Simone Biles, 4'8", 25 world championship medals, 19 of them gold. She's my greatest short athlete of all time. Your thoughts?
No, I don't hate that. I think you should have found a way to get Darren Sproles in there, but you had Barry Sanders, yeah, which I understand. I here's what I would say. To me, by far the most impressive is Spud Webb, and I would even go to Muggsy Bogues as well. All of the other people that you named, right? Guys like Altuve or Barry Sanders or Simone Biles, their height is not a detriment in their sports. If anything, you could argue it helps a running back to be lower to the ground, to be able to hide behind their offensive linemen, that center of gravity like a Barry Sanders. You can argue whether it's Altuve or Pedroia or whoever about being short helping you in baseball with the strike zone, or at least not hurting you. I feel like everybody in gymnastics like Simone Biles is very short. Yes. Spud Webb, that's crazy. Like Spud Webb and Muggsy Bogues in a sport where height is such an asset and lack of it such a detriment. What those guys is unbelievable. I'll tell you what, I hate Spud Webb, Dave. You know why? I'm 6'4 and a half. I've never been able to dunk a basketball. Never.
Is that right?
Ever. In high school, you know, by the time I got 6'4, I was like 235, 240 pounds and just not explosive enough. And I have short arms and small hands, so not explosive enough with that much weight to get up there, overcompensate for my short arms and not being able to palm a ball that well. You know, the closest I ever got to dunking was like my senior year of college. I was 300 pounds. But I had trained so much with all the hang cleans and power cleans. I was so explosive that I could jump up and grab the rim with two hands. I could dunk a tennis ball. Like, that was when I was 300 pounds. And I remember thinking, you know what? When I'm done playing in the NFL, when I'm done with football and I drop 50, 60 pounds, I'm going to be able to throw it down. I am going to be able to dunk. It's going to be sweet. Yeah, well, two torn right MCLs and a back surgery later, I won't even jump an inch. I don't jump. I refuse to jump. Jumping is bad for my body. So Spud Webb makes me feel bad about myself and reminds me that I could never dunk, even though I think I was measured at usually like 6'4 and 5'8". I should have been able to dunk at some point.
Yeah.
I don't have many regrets, Dave. But as much as I loved high school basketball and draining threes, winking at the cheerleaders in the stands at the foul lines, like loved it, loved stuff like that, I would have been downright obnoxious if I could just have dunked. Oh, my gosh. If I could just have dunked in high school basketball. I just wanted to dunk a couple times, maybe flex off of it a little bit, maybe a couple more winks both sides. High school basketball, they could actually see the face. They could see the moneymaker. You know what I mean? Like, oh, unbelievable. Because you dunked it.
Hold on. So you would have been that much more confident. You made it sound as if you're really lacking for confidence. And being able to dunk would have really taken you over the top. Is that what you're telling me, mister? I played in the NFL and went to Princeton. Is that
it? No, I already was confident. It would have allowed me, Dave, to be even more obnoxious on the court. It would have escalated my on-court obnoxious meter if I could dunk in high school basketball. I remember we played a guy, his name's Joey Linderman. He's 6'9 and a half. He played at Reading Central Catholic. He was really good. He went to Drexel. He was the freshman of the year in that conference, whatever that Northeast 10 or whatever it is. I remember telling him, I said, hey, Joey, I really don't. He was a year older than me. Told him this 2 years in a row, Dave, 10th grade and 11th grade. I said, Joey, I really don't care how many points you have, but if you try to dunk, I'm going to put you in the wall. Like, it was like NASCAR. If you try to dunk, I'm going to put you in the wall. And dude, he went like this, Dave. I think he kind of like smiled, and then he could tell, like he smiled and like laughed. Then he could tell I was serious. And I shit you not, okay? I shit you not. The 1 year we're playing, I get in foul trouble, so they take me off of him.
Right, right.
The very next time down the court, they call play. Dude sets a back pick for him, alley-oop, and he throws it down two-handed on the alley-oop. No, it wasn't. I wasn't covering him. I think I had fouled out or I was covering somebody else. Oh, my gosh. Now, could you ever dunk? Did you play high school basketball?
I did play high school basketball, and unfortunately, my shortcoming was these tiny little midget circus freakish hands. I mean, I could be in a circus. I could be – they're like George Costanza's hands.
Give me a
like
high five. Hand model. Give me a high five.
It's pathetic, man. Where are we at? Back it up. 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 And it's hard to gauge. You could palm my hand. It is pathetic. So I always had the leaping ability, but I needed a small ball. I could dunk a girl's ball, which did not do anything for my ego. You know, and I couldn't two-hand slam. I couldn't get that high enough. I could only dunk a girl's ball. So I'm with you. And I thought, okay, maybe I can do it now. And I was out there with my son. I can't even touch the rim now, man. I don't know if it's the back surgery.
What are you doing jumping after two back surgeries?
I just wanted to see if I could like dunk a tennis ball.
No, don't jump. That is the worst. The compression for your back. Don't do that, dude. I'm serious. I care about your back. Don't do that. Don't jump.
It was not a good moment.
Were you a 1 foot jumper or a 2 foot jumper?
I was a 1 foot jumper. You?
2 foot.
2 foot jumper.
Yeah, boy, I was better if I went up, gathered myself, and went up off 2 feet and grabbed the rim like that. If I just tried to run and go off of 1 foot, not as good. I needed both my legs to. But almost like a hang clean, like when you're trying to lift, like boom. You know, this is one of the best things, by the way, about this show. Nobody listening or watching had any idea what was coming to them those last 10 minutes. You didn't know where we were going with that. You didn't know I was going to get mad at Spud Webb. I mean, I didn't even know Dave was going to bring up Spud Webb. I didn't even know we were doing that. He says Spud Webb. It reminds me of the dunk contest where Spud Webb would dunk all the time. And it reminds me that, you know what? That guy made me feel bad about myself because I was way taller and I couldn't dunk. So screw Spud Webb, and I wish I could have dunked. And that's the end of the story.
Well, you must be mad at Zion Williamson. As big as that dude is to be that athletic, I think we can all be mad at him. And now everyone is bummed out as far as the NBA fans go because Zion Williamson out. 6 to 8 weeks he was supposed to play tonight. After a short break, we'll talk about the NBA tipping off tonight. And also that NBA versus China controversy continues. And Michael Jordan making a few headlines as well. Never willing to give a lot of credit to the next generation of ball players. You gotta love the edge from MJ. We'll talk about the NBA opening up tonight after a quick break.